I'd like to now ask for your kind attention on the iron in the clay.
Good evening, brethren and sisters. Daniel 2 is one of those chapters that traditionally we've used a lot in our public proclamations because it's a foundation chapter of our understanding of prophecy. And the reason it is a foundation chapter is because, well, firstly, it explains itself, doesn't it? We're given a vision and then we're given an explanation. And then on top of that, it links in with so many other chapters in the Bible and helps us to understand what they mean. It doesn't just link in with other chapters in Daniel, such as Daniel 4, 7, 8, 11. Doesn't just even link in with just those in Revelation, and we can think of Revelation 12, Revelation 13, Revelation 17, but also chapters all over the place. Joel chapter 1 with the four forms of the caterpillar. Zechariah chapter 1 where you have the four horns. And Zechariah chapter 6 where you have the two brazen mountains, the king of the north and the king of the south. Is connected with the brass of Greece. Ezekiel 38, well, it certainly connects to that, but we'll mention that a bit later. It tells us what it's all about. It explains itself. If we just start at verse 37, verse 36 says, "And we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king." And certainly he does. We read in verse 37, "Thou, O king, art a king of kings, and the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom and power and strength and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven hath he given into thy hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art the head of gold." We're not in any doubt what the head of gold represents. It represents the king of Babylon. It doesn't even just represent Nebuchadnezzar the man, does it? It represents Nebuchadnezzar, the king of kings, the one who had been given the power of the kingdom, strength and glory, who the children of men have been given into his hands. He's given into Nebuchadnezzar's hand as he fills that role of the king of Babylon that God has put all these things into his hand. And of course, it therefore applies to the other kings of Babylon that followed on, those lesser kings of Babylon, before you go on to the other metals of the image. And of course, as we come to verse 39, and let's put that up, shall we? As we come to verse 39, it says, "After thee shall arise another kingdom." It's not another kingdom that's going to exist at the same time as you, Nebuchadnezzar. And I mean, there are symbols where you have 10 kings all existing at the same time. This is sequential. "After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, another third kingdom of brass that shall bear rule over all the earth, and a fourth kingdom that follows on, again, in sequence, shall be strong as iron." And so it goes on. It explains to us there's going to be, you've got this incredible kingdom of Babylon. There's going to be further kingdoms, further empires that follow on after you, Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, if you make the obvious connections with Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, and taking that Babylon that we have named in this chapter, then explicitly we're told the first power is Babylon. The second power is Medo-Persia. The third power is Greece. They are named, aren't they, in Daniel chapter 8. And only the fourth power is not specifically named. But having those first three, it can only be, of course, Rome. And the principles of interpretation of this chapter are so simple. Just listen to what it's telling us. Is really all we can say. Just listen to it. You know, listen to what is mentioned. And if features of this image are mentioned, then they're important. And if features of this image are not mentioned, they're not important. And so, yes, the toes that it talks about when you get down to verse 41 and 42, the toes are significant. They're mentioned in both of those verses. But the fingers are not. We don't have to worry about how many fingers this image has got. We don't have to worry about how many eyes it's got, or its nose, or mouth, or any of these other things which are not mentioned. But the toes are significant because they're mentioned, aren't they? And when you ask, well, how many toes are there? Well, ask other sensible questions. How many arms are there on this image? Doesn't tell you. Doesn't say the breast and two arms of silver. It just says the breast and arms, but there are two. It's the only sensible interpretation you can make. How many legs are there? Doesn't tell you how many legs of iron there are, but the only sensible answer is two. And likewise, when you come to the toes, it doesn't tell you how many there are, but in the absence of any other information, there is only one sensible answer, isn't there? And that is that there are 10 toes. And what we are particularly interested in tonight is the two legs and the feet and toes. And of course, if we know anything about the Roman Empire, we'll know that it divided. It divided into two halves. And from AD 395 onwards, it was never joined again. It remained in those two halves, east and west. And the Western Empire was a Latin empire. And that remains true to our day. You only have to look at the character set that I'm using, and it's the Latin character set. It's not an English character set. It's not a Greek character set. It's the Latin character set. And the font that's on my piece of paper here is Times New Roman. Because we're in the Latin half of the empire. And if you think of the language of many of the nations that are in that Western half, they speak what are known as the Romance languages. And if we can slightly mispronounce that, the Romance languages. I think that's probably where it comes from anyway. I'm not quite sure of the etymology of that word. But anyway, the Romance languages. The Romance languages are Italian, French, Portuguese, Spanish, probably some others. They're languages that are come directly from Latin. And of course there's still Latin kicking around if you're in Rome. And again, in this Western half, the religion, the Roman Catholic Church, is a Latin religion. And the language of the church is Latin. And the educational system in this Western half has been Latin-based traditionally. Even in my lifetime, I was taught Latin at school. Not for very long, I'm glad to say. But Latin and the classics and so on, they were a traditional part of the Western half of what was the Roman Empire, or Western Europe. It's the Latin half of the empire. And likewise, if you look at the architecture in the West, it's very distinctive from the architecture in the East. And when we look at that Western empire, when we look at the Western Empire, well, let's look at the empire like this first. The Roman Empire started in BC 31 when the first emperor, who was Augustus Caesar, the adopted son of Julius Caesar, who was never actually emperor, began there. And of course, it was an the power was firstly imperial. It was ruled by emperors. And as time went on, we come to AD 395. We've already mentioned it. The empire splits permanently into two pieces. And in the West, the empire only continued until AD 476. And in that period, it's gone from being pagan, as it was, to being a Christian empire. Certainly for quite a long time, nearly, well, over 150 years, it's been a Christian empire where Christianity, the Roman Catholic Church, dominates. And anybody who's any other religion, and anybody who protests against the evils of the official form of religion would not be tolerated in that Western Roman Empire. You then have a period when the empire crumbles and is ruled. The same area is still ruled as a Christian empire, an imaginary empire, because it's broken up into pieces, the Gothic period. But come AD 800 and we have a resurrection of the Western Roman Empire, if you like. A man called Charlemagne comes along and he resurrects the Roman Empire as it's seen. And he was crowned as Emperor of Rome by the Pope. And this empire was later called the Holy Roman Empire. And it's symbolized in the Book of Revelation as a beast that looks like a lamb but speaks like a dragon. It's got that outward appearance of being Christian, if you like. But the reality is it's just the same old Roman Empire carrying on. And we can see it as a continuation of the Western Roman Empire. There are so many things that connect it. Incidentally, it lasted over 1,000 years, did that Holy Roman Empire. But it was, if you like, a resurrection of the Western Roman Empire. The rule of it was initially until 1152, they were called Emperors of Rome. After 1152, they became emperors of the Holy Roman Empire. They were also, though, known as the Kaiser, or the Caesar, of the Western Empire. You still had that Roman Catholic connection. And in fact, it was originally born, this Holy Roman Empire, or this Carolingian Empire, to save the Pope from his persecutors. But having said, there are a lot of connections with it, and you can see it as a continuation of the Western leg of the Roman Empire. There is another factor. That was the empire of Charlemagne in the darker green. It's not a Mediterranean empire like Rome was. It's now a European empire. And it's not ruled by Romans, it's ruled by Germans or Germanic people. And Charlemagne was Germanic, and his capital was at Aachen in Germany, not in Rome. So we see a Germanization of the Western Roman Empire, and we see this power in the West, dominated by Germany. And I mean, yes, you can see that the empire still does go down into some of the traditional places there. It goes down, includes Rome there, but his capital, I can spot it in that lot, somewhere around there. Higher up? Where? There it is. There it is, Aachen. Aachen, thank you for that. So what about the Eastern Empire? Coming back to our little picture here, we have, after the division we have the Eastern Roman Empire, which became known as the Byzantine Empire, because it was ruled from Constantinople, and Constantinople was originally called Byzantium. The logic of history, eh? But anyway, it was known as the Byzantine Empire. And people don't realise, when people say the Roman Empire lasted 500 years, and they're talking about that period there, the Imperial Roman Empire, if you go eastward, lasted nearly another 1,000 years after that. And it was very long-lasting, the Eastern Roman Empire. And again, like you see the Latin characteristic in the West, you see the Greek characteristic in the East. And to this day, you only have to look at a Russian character set and realise you can't read it properly. You can't even pronounce it. And it's a Cyrillic alphabet, and the Cyrillic alphabet and various versions thereon, they come essentially from the Greek alphabet. And again, you see an Eastern Orthodox religion. You see an Eastern style of architecture and education and language, again, coming from that Eastern half, from that Greco half of the Roman Empire. And if we think of Brother Thomas, he talks about the Latino Roman Empire and the Greco Roman Empire, the Eastern and the Western parts of the empire. Right, shouldn't have clicked that yet. Right, so coming back then in thought to the image itself, the feet of iron and clay. Well, let's go back to, let's read the passage. Let's read from verse 40 down to verse 43. Verse 40, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And it's emphasized the strength of the iron, and that characteristic remains when we go into the feet. We read in verse 41, and whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so that the kingdom shall be partly strong. See this strength coming through for the iron, and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. Now, first thing you've got to say, iron symbolized Rome, and it symbolized the strength of Rome. You can't have the iron representing Rome in the legs and then say it's got nothing to do with Rome in the feet and toes. It's Rome, and it's the strength of Rome. But what does the clay represent? Well, going back to verse 39, you've had the head of gold in verse 38. After thee, in verse 39, shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and a fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. Now, we all know that if someone offers us an ounce of gold, an ounce of silver, an ounce of brass, and an ounce of iron, we all know which one to pick, don't we, to accept as a gift. And we can see that those metals in value go down. It only explicitly mentions that when it goes from the gold to the silver. But I would say that it is implied that the continuing decrease in value of the metals is significant. Now, why? In what way was the Persian Empire inferior to the Babylonian Empire? It was bigger. It lasted longer. It was a very wealthy empire. I wouldn't like to argue which of the two empires was most wealthy. I don't know, to be honest, but I suspect that you couldn't justify it on purely on the wealth of the empire. So in what sense was the Medo-Persian Empire inferior in value to the Babylonian Empire? Well, let me suggest this as an idea that seems to fit, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, you may disagree. Nebuchadnezzar was an absolute ruler. If you like, the value of his throne, the value of his power was supreme. Whatever he said was law. Whatever he said went. He could change his mind, he could do as he liked. He was absolute ruler. When you come to the Medo-Persians, you only have to read the story of Daniel in the lion's den to know that the Medo-Persian king had to obey his own laws. That's quite a reduction in power. It's one of the fundamentals of modern democracy and so on, that the rulers, whoever you are, you have to still abide by the law. And in the Medo-Persian system, the king had to abide by his own laws. He could make any laws he liked, but once he'd made them, he had to keep them too. And we also see that in Esther, don't we? When Esther's complained about what Haman's about to do, the king is unable to say, okay, just stop it, everybody. We're not going to kill the Jews after all. Or they had to make another law which allowed the Jews to defend themselves. They couldn't undo the first law because the law was unchanging, and even the king had to obey the law. And as you go on, where did democracy begin? It began with the Greeks. They are known as the people that invented democracy. And of course it is a Greek word, isn't it? Democracy. And yes, the king of the Greeks was a powerful man, but there were limits to his power. And when you come to Rome with the Senate and so on, we might think of some of those crazy dictators, people like Caligula and Domitian and Caracalla and many, many others. And we think, wow, they could do what they liked. But you know, their very lives hung by a string, by a thread. They couldn't do what they liked. Their power was constitutionally limited by the Senate and practically limited by the army, by the Praetorian Guards, because if they weren't happy, then, well, your life was going to not be around much longer. And there were occasions when there were 6 emperors in a year because the Roman army kept changing its mind and they would put another emperor in, and the former one, his head would go round on the spike of a javelin or a pilum. So that wasn't like that for Nebuchadnezzar. He could do what he liked with very little fear that someone was going to overthrow him. And of course you come down to the modern days, and I see the feet as the leftovers of the Roman Empire. I see modern Europe as the leftovers of the Roman Empire. There are still the influences of Rome there. There's still particularly things like the Roman Catholic Church, and the Roman Catholic Church in Western Europe. So many of the rulers, so many of that ruling elite, you know, and we still have a ruling elite in countries, even if you have democracy. So many of them are ardent Catholics. And of course, our current president, hardly anybody knew when he came to power, but our current president, Herman Van Rompuy, president of the European Union, and we are actually from the time of the Nice Treaty, we are citizens under that law. He's our president. He is an absolute ardent Catholic who spends regular retreats in a Benedictine monastery. So there's still the power of the Rome there, but what about the clay? Now, you can't get lower in value than clay, can you? When you compare it with gold or silver or brass or iron, clay is worthless. It calls it miry clay in the one place. It's the mud of the earth. It's in abundance, and it's worth nothing, or next to nothing anyway, but probably nothing. And if I'm right in saying that the value represents how much power was invested in that one person, then what you see here is a power that is spread out and very little in any one person. Now, that's actually supported when we come to verse 43, because it says, "And whereas thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay, the iron power, shall mingle themselves with the seed of men." And the word for men there is the word Enosh. And if you look at the words in Hebrew, and this is actually in Aramaic here, but there's an Enosh in Aramaic, and they're very similar languages, and there's an equivalent word in Hebrew. And if you look in your Hebrew at the different words for man in the Old Testament, you have Ish, which literally means a husband, I think, but it's quite a polite term. Like in English, we might refer to someone as a gentleman. You know, it's quite a polite kind of man. Then you have Adam, and we're all familiar with the word Adam as a word for man. Very sort of standard, middle of the road, literal, basic word for man. And then you have Enosh, which Strong's says that it's lower than man, and it means a mortal. So what we have here is that the iron power that's still around today is mingled with the power of the seed of the common man. And I think that's what we have in Europe, in the modern world. Yes, we have certain wealthy and powerful people. Certain people who typically end up in the ruling classes, whether in governments or as head of big corporations or whatever it is. And then on the other hand, you have power via the ballot box. Power via humanist, socialist, democracy. And these two ideas are in contradiction, but they're brought together. As it puts it, in that second half of verse 43, "They shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay." So they're formed together, but they don't really hold together. And that's the modern world as I see it, in this mixture of iron and clay, this mixture of the old Roman power with its strength and this democratic socialist power in the clay of very little value, inferior to all the other materials. And in verse 44 it says, "And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And so what we see here is clearly a latter day power. And if we come back to our little diagram here, we've only come down to 1806 on the west and 1453 in the east. So where do we go from here? Well, let's start with the west. The Holy Roman Empire was known as the First Reich, the First German Empire. It was the first German ruled Western Roman Empire, if you like. But it wasn't the last. The First Reich is called the First Reich because there are more Reichs to come. And of course, there was the Second Reich. And I've got a history book, and it's called The Second Reich. And it's about that German Empire from 1870, established under Chancellor Bismarck with Kaiser Wilhelm I, from that time, 1870, which brings together those disparate German states into one proper nation, and which continued until Kaiser Bill II, Kaiser Wilhelm II, was forced to abdicate at the very end of the First World War. The Second Reich. And after the Second Reich, there's the Third Reich, which is probably far more well known to the modern person than the previous two. Hitler's Third Reich. I have a suspicion that we see today the development of a Fourth Reich. Yet again, I mean, the European Union was created to ensure that Germany never raised itself up to dominate Europe again. And look where we are today. We see Germany again taking that dominating position, but this time they've done it a different way. In fact, they've gone completely round the Rhine, as it were. You know, they've gone in the opposite direction, using the European Union that was intended to prevent it ever happening. But lo and behold, we have the German power dominating Europe again, only in its early stages, I would say. You know, but watch this space. And what about in the East? Well, let me put it up first. I would say that the successor to the Eastern Roman Empire is Russia. And I'll tell you why I think that's the case. When the city of Constantinople fell in 1453 to the Turks, Eastern Rome and the Byzantine court fled north. And Ivan III of Russia married Sophia Pelagog, the niece of Constantine XI, who was the last emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire. He married her, and as time went on, his court was patterned on the court of the Eastern Roman Empire. And you only have to look at a picture of the Kremlin, and you see those onion domes, and go to Constantinople. You can see where these things have come from. And of course, what did he call himself? He came to be known as Tsar. And again, like in the West, where the Holy Roman Emperor, and in fact the Kaisers that came in the Second Reich as well, Caesar, likewise in the East, Tsar is Caesar, come down into modern times. And it's not just me, but Moscow is known as the Third Rome. Just let's look at this last bit. The idea first was suggested by monk Philotius, proclaimed to Caesar Vasili III, two Romes have fallen, the third stands, and there will be no fourth. No one will replace your Christian czardom. And, of course, the first city, capital city of the Roman Empire, was Rome. In 312 or so, Constantine moved it to a town that was previously called Byzantium, but he renamed it Constantinople. That was the second Rome. And the third Rome, it is recognised by quite a lot of historians, is Moscow. And a very funny coincidence, if you type in Seven Hills into your Wikipedia, the top three cities that come up as having seven hills are Rome, Constantinople, and Moscow. Seven hills, of course, I'm referring us to Revelation chapter 17. And we have in the West, the European Union. We have in the East being developed a Eurasian Union, where Putin is trying to bring back together the old former Soviet Union countries back under his domination. And there are several countries who have already agreed to join. The terms are more stick than carrot, I suspect. So we see Eastern, Western powers being brought back together, the leftovers of the Roman Empire. And another thing that's of vital importance is that modern Europeans are the descendants of 10 barbarian tribes. And I think that's where the 10 toes come from. Because when we look at the 10 toes, that's not very good, but anyway, you may notice that in this drawing, which seems fairly rational to me, that five toes are on each foot. Now, I know various have sort of said, well, you know, the European Union, well, it could be this country and this country and this country. Before, when there were only about 10 members of the European Union, that, well, they were the 10 toes. Now there's 27, is there? Has it gone up above that? I don't know how many there are, but there's certainly more than 10. But the key factor is there's five toes on each foot. There's five toes in the East and five toes in the West, which might make you start to scratch your head and think, well, what's the significance of five? You know, if there's five kings in the Western Europe and five kings in the Eastern Europe, it doesn't actually make sense. Because when you look in Revelation, where again you have two beasts, one representing the East and one representing the West, they have 10 horns each. Here we've got 10 shared between the feet. And I think that's significant. Because what that indicates is when you have the two powers and they're separate, they need 10 horns each, because they're descended from 10 tribes, 10 barbarian tribes. And what it's telling you, like Israel might be symbolized by 12, and the Jews that in America, well, you could still say they're descended from the 12, and the Jews that in Russia, you could say, well, they're still symbolized by 12, and the Jews that are in the land, they're still symbolized by 12. Same with the Europeans. They are the descendants of 10 tribes, 10 barbarian tribes. So if you want to talk about a Western European power, you give it 10 horns. If you want to talk about an Eastern European power, you give it 10 horns, because 10 tells you they've come from those barbarian tribes. But when you say, well, let's get East and West, and I know these are hands, but I'm not very good at standing the other way up. When you get East and West and you join it back together and you want to say this is a European confederation, you only give it 10, because they're joined together. And that's what's being told you, I think, there. While there's two separate powers, they need 10 horns each. When they become one, 10 is all they need to fit the symbology. And what we're looking for is not only a development of a German-dominated Europe in the West and a Russian-dominated Europe in the East, we are looking for those two powers to come together to form one great power that's described in that list of nations in Ezekiel 38. And if you'd come back with me to verse 35, I think it is. Here's the actual dream being described in verse 35. You've had the stone cut out of the mountain without hands. Verse 35, then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver and the gold broken to pieces together. Now the Babylonian Empire was from something like BC 586 to BC 516. That's quite a long time ago, really. The Persian Empire was, well, I'm not going to try and figure out the numbers, but they're all a long time ago. How is it when Christ returns to the earth with, and when Christ comes with his saints, how is he going to destroy the Babylonian Empire and the Medo-Persian Empire and the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire and grind them in pieces together? How is he going to do that? Brother Thomas saw the same issue and he said, well, there's two, we're being shown two things here. Yes, we're seeing that continuous historic account which shows us how it comes down through the centuries and the stone is going to hit it on the feet and toes because it's going to be in the days of those kings. But there has to be in some way that the image will stand again as one power at that last day. And it will be the sum of all those previous empires. It won't just be at the sum of the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Greek and the Romans, but it will also be a sum of those empires that have developed out of them. So you can add those four together, throw in the Holy Roman Empire and the things that have grown out of that, throw in the Russia that's come up in as the successor in the eastern half, and what you get then is that Gogian power described in Ezekiel 38. The European, the eastern and western Roman Empire parts of that great power in the past. You'll see countries like Iran. Well, of course, there's the Persian Empire. You'll see in the parts of North Africa. Well, the Roman Empire ruled across North Africa. You'll see up in Germany, none of those four empires ruled in Germany. But the Holy Roman Empire was up there, and so is the European Union. And you'll see Russia. Eastern Roman Empire never ruled up to Moscow or anywhere near it. But you add those in together, and you see the standing up of the image empire to come about in those last days so that it can be, as it says, let me read it again, because when you actually read it, it's so powerful. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver and the gold broken to pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor. We were supposed to do that. And so Daniel chapter 2 is a foundation of prophetic understanding. It expounds itself and it helps us to understand so many prophetic chapters that are in the Bible. And it enables us to see God's hand at work amongst the nations today. It teaches us to expect a German-dominated Western Europe and Russian-dominated Eastern Europe, and it teaches us to expect those powers to come together as a confederation of some sort, to come together in those latter days. And when we see those things come to pass, reading again from verse 44, and in the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand for ever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it brake in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. The dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure. In fact, I missed out one minor point. Well, not a minor point. Nebuchadnezzar was told that it was to show him what would happen in the latter days. It's not just the continuous historic. It's what would happen in the latter days. But this chapter shows us that we are in those last days. And the purpose of God will be fulfilled. And look at the little parable, the little picture that we have at the end in verse 46. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar, who was king of the kingdom of men, that stands against Christ. I mean, this whole image represents the kingdom of men that stands against God. And he, Nebuchadnezzar, is the king of it. Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel, and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odours unto him. And the king answered Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. And when Christ and his saints grind that image to powder, the nations will at last fall down and acknowledge the God of gods and the King of kings, that is the God of Israel. And we look for that day when the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea, as we read in Habakkuk. And we read in Isaiah 2, of course, it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of God from Jerusalem. And we look forward to that time, and we have to realize that prophecy can change our lives, because we can see God's hand at work around us, and so it moves us, so it excites us, so it encourages us and makes us able to overcome the flesh. Prophecy gives us faith, and by faith we overcome. By faith we can be counted righteous, and by faith we can stand at the judgment seat and so enter into the joy of our Lord. Thank you very much.